MechCast, Sunday, February 1st, 2015. This episode of the MechCast is brought to you by Lynda.com. Invest in yourself and sign up for a free 10-day trial of Lynda.com by visiting lynda.com/MechCast. And by Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it's looking like we finally have some news to talk about, some stuff happening in the world of Apple. Specifically, their quarterly results. We're going to be diving into those, and let me just give you a little hint. They're good, if you haven't heard already. Very, very good, as a matter of fact. We're also going to get some of the latest updates on our rumors, specifically surrounding the Apple Watch. We also have some stuff related to HomeKit and possibly Apple TV, some Apple updates to tell you about, and a whole lot more. And then we're going to get into your comments and questions. I'm going to talk about what I'm calling the other iOS problem, or iOS's other problem, rather. And does Siri know a little bit too much about us? And I guess we got a few Siri things in this episode. And then an interesting little issue. We're going to try and help someone out with a strange image and message on his logon screen. And then, of course, we have the thing of the moment. And it's going to be a really great show. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Lynda.com. You know, we're already a month into the new year, and now is a perfect time to start expanding your tech skills, maybe learn something completely new, start a new career, move on to another career, expand your existing career, what have you. And Lynda.com is a great place to start. As a matter of fact, I think it's one of the perfect places to start. They have over 3,000 courses on topics like web development, photography, visual design, business, you name it, they have a course for you. And all of their courses are taught by industry experts, people who know what they're doing, amazing instructors, and they add new courses to the site every week. So whether you want to set new financial goals for yourself, find a better work-life balance, invest in a hobby more deeply, maybe you want to ask your boss for a raise, get a better job, improve your current position or skills in 2015, Lynda.com really has something for everyone. One thing I really love about Lynda.com is that they target all skill levels. They have courses like iOS 8, iPhone, and iPad Essential Training. They have Swift Essential Training. So you can go from the basics of iOS all the way up into Swift, the latest and greatest programming language from Apple. And right now they have this really cool thing they're doing called Code Clinic that I think is really interesting. It's an innovative series where each month Lynda.com issues a coding challenge and they have their authors share the solution for that coding challenge using a bunch of different programming languages. So you can see how one programming language solves the same challenge differently than, say, another programming language or maybe similarly. And it is a really unique and interesting way to learn. So they've got that. I use Lynda.com. I recently started a project, and I had to learn a PHP framework called Laravel. And lo and behold, Lynda had a Laravel 4 Essential Training course. And that helped me get right up to speed so that I could dive into that project and really take it head on. So I want you to try it out. And best of all, you can sign up for a free 10-day trial via the MacCast by visiting lynda.com/MacCast. And once you sign up, you're going to get unlimited access to every course on lynda.com for 10 days. You're going to have access to view the tutorials on your tablet, on your phone, on your Android device. So you can do it when you're out and about. And like I said, they're adding new courses all the time. So you get the latest and greatest courses from lynda.com. So invest in yourself. Sign up for the free 10-day trial at lynda.com by visiting lynda.com/MacCast. And go ahead, I challenge you to learn something new in 2015. And a big thank you to Lynda for their support of the show. So let's jump into those quarterly numbers from Apple. Apple's quarterly windfall, it was amazing. They turned out to be even bigger and better than anyone predicted, including Apple themselves. Apple's always pretty conservative on their guidance, so it's not surprising. But this time, I think they were very conservative, and even Wall Street ended up being conservative. Apple posted revenue of $74.6 billion and a net quarterly profit of $18 billion. That's compared to last year's numbers, which were $57.6 billion with a net quarterly profit of $13 billion. $18 billion, by the way, in profit. That makes Apple, or that is rather, the most profit ever reported by a publicly traded company. So just an amazing, amazing figure. Within that, something that I found interesting is that international sales, again, seems to lead most of Apple's revenue. 65% of the revenue was actually accounted for by international sales, with China being a real key market for Apple in the quarter. Revenue in China increased from $9.5 billion to $16.14 billion. That's a year-over-year increase of like 70%. So huge numbers posted in China. Breaking down some of the other countries, the U.S. accounted for $30.566 billion. Europe brought in $17.214 billion. China was in third, believe it or not, at $16.144 billion, followed by Japan at $5.448 billion. Right now, Apple holds $178 billion in cash. I think Tim Cook's investing friend, Carl Icahn, or Icahn, I can never remember how you say it. I think it's Icahn. Carl Icahn is already calling for Apple to do more stock buybacks with that cash. So they're also spending a lot more on R&D, so that is being reinvested, things like that. Of all those revenues and profits, the iPhone, logically, I think, accounted for a big portion of that. iPhone sales were up 51 million units from the quarter a year ago, coming in at 74.5 million units sold. That's a new record for Apple. About two-thirds of Apple's revenue was actually from iPhone sales. For fun, Tidbits pointed out that this means that Apple was selling an average of 34,000 iPhones every hour of every day for the quarter. That's just, it's mind-blowing when you start putting these numbers in perspective. Apple also shipped its 1 billionth iOS device in the quarter, which happened to be a 64-gigabyte iPhone 6 Plus, in case you're taking notes. Macs were also did very well for the quarter. They sold strongly. Apple moved 5.5 million units. That was up from 4.8 million units in the same quarter last year, an increase of 14%. And that's really impressive considering that if you look at the lineup, Apple really only released two completely new desktop models this year and had pretty much what was just updates to its notebook lines. I mean, there were significant updates, but Apple's not pushing out a lot of new Mac products. So to be continuing to sell that number of computers, desktops, and notebooks is really impressive. Also considering the fact that, in general, PC sales are on the decline. One number that continues to be a struggle for Apple is iPad sales. They continue to slow showing in the quarter. They were at 21.4 million units. That was down from 26 million in the year ago quarter, so a decline of about 18%. Tim Cook still tried to be upbeat about iPad, focusing on, you know, his favorite usage numbers. He pointed out that iPad accounted for about 82% of U.S. e-commerce transactions from tablets. So those people that do have iPads are using their iPads. He also said that the first-time buyer rate for iPads was 50% in developing markets and 70% elsewhere. For me, you know, I think iPads and tablets are generally victims of their own success, their own robustness. I may have talked about this in the past. You know, they work very well for the tasks that we want to use them for, and they don't give a lot of issues or problems, right? There's not a lot of reasons to replace your tablets. And when Apple's been doing updates, you get minor advances, things like Touch ID. I'd love to have Touch ID on my iPad, but it's just not enough for me to want to upgrade my iPad Air, which functions and works very, very well. So I think consumers are going to be more apt to be replacing their tablets maybe every 3 years or so. And it's more on that sort of PC upgrade cycle. And Tim kind of admitted that. He also admitted that there is some iPad cannibalization happening due to larger screen iPhones. So a lot of people are going to be holding off on a new tablet purchase. I would think, especially if you're more of a mini fan, if you have a larger screen phone, that device is going to maybe get you by a little bit longer. So I think iPad sales are going to kind of reach that maturity level where they're just going to flatten out. Most people who have tablets got them already, and now they're just waiting for that upgrade cycle. So it's going to take a lot longer. And I think we'll see Apple kind of scale back on what they're doing with iPads in terms of putting out new models and things like that. I think they're still going to innovate, but I think it's going to continue to be the same sort of thing where it's minor revisions, updates, nothing that's going to compel someone to give up the iPad they just bought last year. But when year two, three rolls around and it's feeling like it's time for a new tablet, they'll jump in and get them then. So I don't think it's anything to worry about, but just something to note from the call. The other category, this is the new category that Apple developed that includes the iPod, Apple TV, Beats Electronics, all their accessories, that brought in $2.7 billion. That was a year-over-year decrease of 5.2%. Not really sure why that went down, probably mostly because of iPods. iPods have been on the decline for quite a while. Apple's not breaking it out now, so we don't know which thing within that lineup, but I think we can kind of logically maybe point at iPods, versus Apple TV or maybe Beats headphones. In the iTunes software and services category, that has now been relabeled simply services. Apple made $4.8 billion. That was up from $4.4 billion. And then really the bombshell of the entire call, Tim Cook gave out, I think during the Q&A, I don't remember specifically when this was brought up, but he finally gave us a much more firm date on the release date for the Apple Watch. We now know that, quote unquote, early 2015 means sometime in April of 2015. So he said April. Most of us are thinking it's going to be toward the end of the month. Apple usually does the launch on a Friday. So pick, you know, a Friday in the last 1 or 2 weeks of the month and you'll probably nail the release date. But overall, just amazing numbers posted from Apple this quarter and really shocking and surprising. It's great to see them doing so well. And I think 2015 is really going to be the year of the Apple Watch, and we'll have to see how well that product does for Apple moving forward. So speaking of the Apple Watch, we've got more updates, some of the latest Apple Watch rumors. Battery life has been one of those things that a lot of people have wanted to know about. There's been a lot of questions, a lot of conversations surrounding battery life. And it's really one of the biggest things we've had since the announcement. I would think after, you know, when's the release date and what's the pricing going to be? We kind of know the pricing because it's starting at $349. We don't know each model, but we have something there and now we have a release date. So now battery is that thing that a lot of us are thinking about again. And Tim Cook has given hints stating that it's going to be something customers are going to want to charge daily. So that kind of makes you think, okay, it's going to be every day. But what is that? Is that 15 hours? Is that 20 hours? Is that 24 hours? Well, 9to5 Mac claims that they've heard from sources who say that Apple has been reportedly aiming for a 2.5 hours of heavy application use on the Apple Watch, 3.5 hours of standard app use, and 4 hours of pure fitness tracking. So keep in mind, these numbers we're talking about, this is if you launched a heavy app, and I don't even know what we define as a heavy app at this point, because third-party developers can't make games or anything that's going to run directly on a processor. But just imagine the watch is on, it's doing a lot of intensive processing, it's doing a lot of communication with the Bluetooth and things like that. 2.5 hours. So roughly what that supposedly translates into real world hours for you and I who are walking around using these things, you know, you're going to look at the watch, you're going to interact with an application, you're going to put it down, it's going to go to sleep, it's going to go into that active passive mode. And Apple says when it's running in that, or rather 9to5 is saying, their sources are saying that it will run 19 hours with that amount of usage. And even there, they're claiming that Apple is struggling to hit that target. So 19 hours would be what would amount to a full day's worth of usage, because you got to remember, you wake up in the morning, you're going to sleep at night, so you got to take out 8 hours for sleeping somewhere, if you're getting enough sleep, of course. If you're like me, it's maybe 4 or 5 hours in there. But that still gets you 19 hours of active use, 5 hours of sleeping, that gets you your 24 hours, so you have a 1 day worth of use. It's, they also claim that they're targeting a 3 day of pure standby time and 4 days if the watch is sleeping. I guess that's if you just leave it on the nightstand and you want to pick it up a couple days later. I'm thinking if you have an Apple Watch, you're going to want to be wearing it and using it all the time. So I'm not sure how that comes into play, but at least some numbers that we can go off of. The watch should be able to display the clock face, according to the report, for approximately 3 hours, including having the watch ticking animation. So if you're not doing anything else on the watch, but you just had it held up the entire time and we're watching the dial go around, I guess it's going to last about 3 hours. Again, most of the time that watch face is going to be turned off. It's going to be in that standby mode, and it only comes on when you raise your wrist. And I had a listener email in because I had complained about this, you know, 1 day. I didn't think 1 day of battery life was enough, and I figured maybe 2-3 days, that would be a better target for Apple to hit. Well, someone emailed and pointed out that really daily charging is probably a better scenario than 2 or 3 day charging. So think about 36 hours or 48 hours of battery life. Because of how it varies by how you're using the watch, you're not really going to know when are you going to hit that point, right? It's going to be sometime within the second half of the second day, or maybe you make it partially the way to the third day, but you might be out and about, you might be somewhere. And with a watch, it's not like a phone. It's not the kind of thing where you're going to run into a coffee shop and you're going to plug into the outlet and charge your phone for a couple hours, or you're running through the airport and you're going to sit down and you're going to plug it into the wall. You're not going to be wanting to do that with your watch. So it really makes sense that you would charge it every night, wake up in the morning, you have a full charge, it's going to get you through the entire day, and then you charge it again the next night. You're not going to have to worry about your battery dying midday like we do with phones, and you're not going to have battery packs to, you know, sort of slide into your watch. It's just going to be, it doesn't make sense. So it almost makes more sense to have it be a daily charger. And I thought that was a very valid point. And I'm kind of coming to grips with that concept, but I don't know. I also have my Pebble watch, and it gets 4 or 5 days, something like that. I have had it sort of run out midday or get down to 10 or 20%, and I have to take it off. I have to go put it on the stand, and then I'm not using it, and I'm not getting all the benefits from it. So I think it's really going to prove out the one-day battery life, or how it works, is really the proof is going to be in how it works when we actually have the device and we're using it. Tim Cook says he's been using one, and he absolutely loves it. Can't live without it, so it must be working for him, although I think he has a slight bias. What do you think? A few other things on the Apple Watch rumors. The S1 chip, it's saying that performance is going to be similar to that of an Apple A5, which I find very impressive. So when Apple does open up that SDK and allow the watch to do a little bit more, or developers to develop apps, they should have enough power within the S1 chip to actually do some pretty interesting things. And as far as what the display is, we've heard now that the display is a 60 frame per second Retina class display. Whatever that means, I'm not really sure. We don't actually have numbers, but there you go. 60 frames per second Retina class display on your Apple Watch. Now let's move on and talk a little bit about Apple TV and HomeKit. There's more and more traction coming up on this concept that the Apple TV might turn into a little bit of a HomeKit hub. So for all your smart devices that can connect into HomeKit, the Apple TV could be controlling a few things. We've already heard and discussed the reports that if you want to communicate with your HomeKit devices at home while you're away, you are going to need a latest gen Apple TV. Or, you know, again, none of this stuff has been confirmed, but it's heavily rumored that that functionality is going to be in there. We do know that the current Apple TV, the third gen latest version, does have HomeKit support built into it. So if you're out and about and you want to tell Siri to turn the lights off at your house or check your lights or check your security system, that HomeKit command is going to have to run through an Apple TV. And that just makes sense. You need to have something that's there at home connected to the internet that can then talk to those other devices on your home network. And that just seems logical. If Apple wasn't going to use that, I would imagine they'd have to use something like an airport router. And that's a bit more expensive. I think Apple can convince more people to buy an $80 hub for their HomeKit via the Apple TV more readily than a $200 router, when maybe they prefer to have a Linksys or a Netgear or something like that, right? So now we're hearing, though, that the Apple TV might also bring HomeKit control to non-HomeKit devices on your home network. So this would mean that devices that were designed for other standards, things like Z-Wave or Zigbee, smart home protocols, those would be able to work somewhat on your HomeKit network. There are some severe limits. So when I first heard this story, I got pretty excited. I thought, oh, this is kind of a smart thing. This would be a great way to go. Turns out that home automation devices, things like thermostats, remote door locks or remote locks, smart lights, those are not supported if they don't have HomeKit built into them, even if you have an Apple TV. So the dream of your Nest thermostat being able to get HomeKit control, probably not going to happen unless Google agrees to actually work it into the Nest itself. So that bummed me out. But what is likely to be possible is things like data collection devices and things that enhance the home theater experience. So think speakers, but not remote control devices. And why the severe limits? Well, security is sort of the number one thing being thrown out here. It's being said that non-HomeKit devices wouldn't be subject to Apple's made-for-eye certification. So Apple's going to have less control over those devices. They're not going to be able to kind of know what those things are doing. So they're going to want to keep them sort of out of the HomeKit ecosphere so that they don't get into any trouble there, right? Apple wants to be able to control that experience, make sure it's flawless, it's plug and play, things work together. So that still means that you may be able to ask Siri to get the temperature from your non-HomeKit smart weather station at your house as long as you have an Apple TV on that same network. And Apple is working on the certification standards. They do have that out there for HomeKit, and it's pretty rigid for the chips and the products that are in HomeKit. And that, we're starting to hear too, might be leading to some of the delays in seeing those HomeKit products that we saw announced at CES. A lot of vendors came out. They had HomeKit products that they were showing off. They were giving ship dates as early as late this quarter, maybe next quarter. But now we're hearing that even devices hitting the streets next quarter might be optimistic. Recode is reporting that we should save our HomeKit money until the spring at the earliest, and that Apple has only made the HomeKit spec available. Well, they just made it available in October, and they're just setting up the made-for-eye licensing for the HomeKit program. They did that in November. So developers of products are rushing to kind of get that stuff in there. And reportedly, Broadcom has some new chips that are ready to go that would work with HomeKit and support it. But even their software for those chips is not certified yet. So some of the early products are actually looking to probably launch with existing chip technology that's already certified by the Made for Eye program so that they can get through there. So it's like this lineup, right? The chips have to get approved, and then the devices themselves have to get approved, and that may lead to some delays. So I'm very excited about HomeKit, about getting these products and starting to play around with them and integrate them. Just right now, it's unclear on when we'll actually be able to, you know, go into Home Depot and actually buy something with a Made for HomeKit or HomeKit-supported logo on it. And I'm hoping Apple does some sort of branding to indicate on the packaging, you know, when we're buying it, something beyond. I guess if it has the M for I logo or MFI Made for I logo on it, maybe that's enough. But it'd be nice to see a little HomeKit-compatible icon. And I have a feeling at least some vendors are going to give it that sort of labeling so that you know when you're picking it up off the shelf that you're getting something that's going to work with that. But I'm getting very excited about HomeKit. What do you think? Is this something that is going to appeal to you? I think the idea of finally getting easy, smart home automation that integrates with our iOS devices and particularly Siri, that's something that jazzes me up quite a bit. So yeah, let me know what you think. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. Here we go again. We are getting that flip-flopping, reportedly, of the Apple A9 chip production. You know, who's going to get it? Is it going to be Samsung? Is it going to be Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC? Well, a business publication in South Korea says it's going to be Samsung this week. I think this changes every week, but according to a MacNN piece, they say The publication claims that Samsung is going to get about 75% of the orders for Apple's next generation iOS processor. If that's true, that means TSMC would likely get the remaining 25% of orders. And this would be a flop in the current power struggle between the two companies vying to be Apple's main chip supplier. It's currently believed that the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus chips, TSMC is supplying about 60% of those processors, with Samsung supplying the other 40% of the A8s. So we're going to have a flip-flop in power, at least with the latest rumors that we've been hearing. Stay tuned, because it could change next week. Apple issued two OS updates, one for OS X and one for iOS. First up, we got OS X 10.10.2 for Yosemite. It has a number of bug fixes and updates. It resolves an issue that may cause Wi-Fi to disconnect. So everybody who's been having the Wi-Fi issue, and that's been a big one since Apple released Yosemite, it reportedly fixes that. I think it also addresses and fixes the Bluetooth issues, although those weren't a bullet point in this. It reportedly solves an issue that may cause web pages to load slowly. Fixes an issue that caused Spotlight to load remote email content when the preference was disabled in Mail. So that was the security issue that we talked about, I think, last time or maybe a couple shows back, where if you're doing a Spotlight search and email came up, you could get the email preview even if you didn't allow that. And that allowed like tracking pixels and things like that to be registered. So if you got spam email, it was registered like as if you had read it, which was not a good thing. So it's good to see they closed that up. Improves audio and video sync when using Bluetooth headphones. Adds the ability to browse iCloud Drive in Time Machine. That's nice. I hadn't noticed that. Improves voiceover speech performance. Resolves an issue that caused voiceover to echo characters when entering text on a web page. Addressed an issue that may cause the input method to switch languages unexpectedly. Improved the stability and security of Safari. And Apple also did release, along with 10.10.2, standalone Safari updates for OS X Mavericks 7.1.3 and Mountain Lion 6.2.3. So if you're running those older operating systems, you're going to get those improved stability and security updates for Safari. And then Apple also did release a security update for the older operating systems. Security update 2015-001 is available for Mavericks and Mountain Lion. And Apple's always done a pretty good job of making sure they security patch, I think, usually the last three versions of the operating system. So that's good. If you're running something older, you probably want to look at upgrading if you can at all, just to make sure that you're getting all of the security patches and updates and keeping your Mac secure. And then Apple did release the latest update to iOS 8, iOS 8.1.3. It reduced the amount of storage required to do an app update. So if you remember, iOS 8 had this problem where a lot of people couldn't update because they didn't have enough free space on their devices to do the over-the-air update. So this addresses that issue. If you still have issues, though, you can always dock into iTunes and run the update from there. That way it'll put the temporary files local on your Mac and it doesn't have to load them onto the device. But it remains to be seen. They didn't give a lot of details about how much less storage space it takes up. But if you had problems in the past, this might get you past that and allow you to do over-the-air updates on smaller sized devices. Reportedly fixed an issue that prevented some users from being able to enter their Apple ID password for messages and FaceTime. Fixed a bug in Spotlight where it would stop showing app results. In my case, I had many times when Spotlight didn't show any results. That does seem to be mostly fixed. I still had a few times where results don't come up or they come up very, very slowly. So I'm not sure what's going on there. Now maybe they just need to address a performance issue with Spotlight in iOS 8. I'm not really sure. And this is on my iPhone, 6 Plus, so the latest and greatest system that's running an A8, so it should be plenty of horsepower there to be able to do that. Fixed an issue with multitasking gestures on the iPad. It added new configuration options for education standardized testing. One thing it was reported it does not seem to fix is a recent GMT bug that was causing calendar syncing issues and time zone confusion for some people. So if you've been suffering from that issue, it looks like the update might not have fixed that one. So you're going to want to grab the latest. If you're running Yosemite, grab the latest update for Yosemite. If you're running iOS 8, grab the latest update there. Some good stuff in there. You know, I think there's still a few bugs and things to be fixed, but much better than it has been. And then Apple also released an update to iTunes, iTunes 12.1, and it added a new Notification Center widget that you will have to go into your notification settings and actually turn on and activate. So if you don't see it, but what it'll allow you to do is get some iTunes controls inside the Today view inside Notification Center. So you can get play, pause, and you can see track information. I don't think they have the album art yet. It doesn't show the album art or the volume controls, but at least you can do play, pause, and you can scrub and skip tracks and things like that. And of course, if you're playing iTunes Radio, they didn't forget to put in the buy button, so you can quickly buy the music that you want. And Apple says the iTunes 12.1 update also does include or bring improved performance when syncing music or data to an iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch. And I'm assuming that means both wired and over wireless. So let us know how the updates have worked for you, but those are the latest updates for your operating systems. So does Apple Pay have a security problem? This was something that popped up this week, a big story, a lot of flashy headlines that made you panic and think, oh my God, Apple Pay has been hacked. Apple Pay is probably one of the most secure payment platforms available right now. If you look at all of the other things out there and compare them to Apple Pay, I think Apple Pay has security advances that, you know, nothing else can touch. You have things like NFC, tokenization, the secure enclave on the chip, Touch ID, and the combination of all of that makes it really hard to hack the data that is stored or transmitted from the iPhone during an Apple Pay transaction. But what about security of the data going into the device? And that's what got called into question this last week. The blog Drop Labs highlighted a potential risk. And I think this is something we kind of speculated and talked about on the MacCast when Apple Pay was first announced. But they highlighted this potential risk with Apple Pay that is when the card is going into the phone or being put into the phone, how do you know that card belongs to the person who's entering it in? How do you know that's the owner? And in the Drop Labs piece, the author writes that credit card issuers try to keep fraud rates under a number called 10 BPS. And that essentially means less than 10 cents for every $100 worth of transactions. So less than 10 cents of fraud for every $100 worth of transactions. And with Apple Pay, the credit card companies were hoping to beat that 10 BPS number, get it down to about 2 to 3 BPS or 2 cents to 3 cents for every $100 worth of transactions. But what he's reporting is that the rate is actually proving to be much higher than with traditional credit cards. And this was shocking. But the good news, I guess, if you're Apple, is the issue isn't Apple or the technology. It's actually how the verifications are being handled by the banks and the credit card issuers. So it's that vector point when you're putting the cards into the iPhone, into the Apple Pay system. How does that stuff get verified? And Apple actually requires that when cards are added to Apple Pay, what they call provisioning or provisioned into Apple Pay, they require that card issuers build something called a yellow path, which is some way to verify that the card being entered does belong to the person who's entering it. It's like an ownership verification. You know, this is my account, this is my credit card, and I'm putting it into the system. And the best method for doing that seems to be to require someone to authenticate the card with the card issuing bank's app on the device. So in my case, when I add my Chase cards, I have the Chase app on my phone, I've logged into my account, or when I'm adding a card, it might ask me to log into my account, verify my credentials there, and then that will allow the card to be added to Apple Pay. So it has to have something that I know my password, and I have to be able to log into my bank to be able to add the card. What's happening, though, is that most credit card companies for their yellow path seem to be choosing a phone call. And that seems to be where things are going wrong. So what's happening is all of those typical identity theft problems that we have are coming into play, because at that point, you just need to know some additional information, maybe a bank account number, maybe a social security number. So if fraudsters buy stolen consumer identities complete with credit card information, they have most of the information that they need to convince both software and manual checks within the system that they're the legitimate customer. And it's allowing them to add credit cards into Apple Pay. And then that makes it easier for credit card thieves, because guess what? They don't have to make fake credit cards anymore. They can just use Apple Pay. They've got a virtual credit card now in their pocket. So that's what's going on. I think banks are going to have to take a better look at what they're doing with YellowPath. I'm sure Apple's going to get involved and probably work with them more closely to institute better verification systems, more secure verification systems. Another one that's better than just doing a phone call in would be a text message back to the phone of the bank holder's phone. So, you know, my phone number, my cell phone could be registered with my bank or my card issuer. And when I try and add a card to Apple Pay, it sends me a PIN code that I have to put in only to my device, right? So that's something physical I have to have access to. So I guess that would protect me as long as my phone hasn't been stolen. But if my phone's been stolen, I've got other protections that Apple's provided me, right? I have got my PIN code lock. I've got my Touch ID. I can remote wipe it, all those sorts of things. So that would be a better way to handle this as well. And it's something definitely Apple's going to have to look into a little bit further. Some more news on the Apple front that's more positive. You'll soon be able to use Apple Pay at over 200,000 vending machines, coffee brewers, parking stations, kiosks, and laundry machines. Apple USA Technologies rather has announced that it is going to support Apple Pay in its self-service stations. So pretty soon you'll be able to buy candy bars with your Apple Pay. That'll be a fun thing to do. And then Western Union also announced that it's begun accepting Apple Pay for money transfers and bill payments. And Apple Pay has had really, really good success so far. I think it's only going to continue to grow. As a matter of fact, in the quarterly conference call, Tim Cook noted that that $2 out of every $3 spent using contactless payment systems in the U.S., because Apple Pay is only in the U.S., have been being made with Apple Pay. So Apple Pay doing very, very well. I'm using it more and more. More and more places seem to be accepting it. I always ask, or sometimes I just try it on the terminal and find out, whoa, it worked. So I am loving Apple Pay. I don't know about you, but I think it's really, really great stuff. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, if you're thinking about picking up a new iPhone 6 or 6 Plus, guess what? Gazelle wants to buy your current iPhone. They'll give you cash, and that's cash you can use to purchase your new device. And best of all, you can get your offer, you can lock in your price, you can buy your new device, and then do the exchange, get your cash back. So you don't have to be without a phone, any of that sort of stuff. And what I love about Gazelle is how easy and simple they make it for you to get that offer and to get paid. Basically, you go to the website, answer a few questions about the condition of your device. They give you a fair and upfront offer. They'll even buy broken devices, so don't worry if it's broken. They can give you an offer on those as well. You see the price right there. If you want to take advantage of it, they will pay shipping and in many cases even provide a box for you to send it in. You send it in. They look it over, make sure it matches everything you said, and then you get paid fast by check, by PayPal, or even Amazon gift card. And if you choose that option, you can get 5% more. So you just go to gazelle.com. That's GAZELLE.com. Look up your item, answer those few questions. The process takes literally just a few minutes, and you're good to go. And you don't want to wait. The longer you wait, the prices go down over time. So you want to get it in there, lock in your price. So even if you're considering it, lock in your price now. And then when you make your decision, you can get paid and do that. And Gazelle has handled over 2 million trade-ins. They've paid out $175 million to their customers. And over 90% of people using Gazelle report having an excellent experience. And you can certainly count me in that 90%. I've used them several times, as a matter of fact. I might be sending them an old iMac that I have here pretty soon. I just upgraded to a new Mac Mini, and not really sure what to do with the old one. So I'm going to get an offer from Gazelle and take it from there. So what are you waiting for? Take a minute, find out what your iPhone's worth. Go to gazelle.com to find out. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So now I want to talk about iOS and iOS's other problem. And you've seen it, right? You might think I'm being aloof, but I know you've seen it. When I tell you what we're talking about, so maybe I am being a little aloof, you're going to go, oh, yeah, that's the thing. When you plug your iOS device into iTunes and you select the device and you're looking there in the summary tab and you look down at the bottom and you see all of the things that are taking up storage space on your iPhone or your iOS device, and there's this big, large chunk of data, big, fat yellow bar that says other, right? What the heck is other? And, you know, I've wondered it, you've wondered it, we've all gone, what the heck is this other thing? I get music, I get videos, that makes sense, right? Other? Well, other is things like your Safari bookmarks, your text messages, including mail and SMS and their attachments. So if you're getting MMS or you're getting attachments in mail, guess where they are? They're sitting there in that other thing. Calendar entries. You also have iTunes data in there, specifically things like cached files from songs that you've streamed. That gets chunked into that whole other category. And then you have documents and data from apps, including any kind of offline data from apps. So if you have a podcast app, for example, and say it's set up to automatically download your favorite shows, it's going to be storing that data in that other area. Or if you have a RSS reader that stores offline content, I have a lot of those. Your articles and all that offline content, or Pocket or things like that, that all gets consumed up into that other category. And that can build up over time, and it can start to take up quite a bit of space. So I get asked quite frequently, and this happened this week, which is what brought up this topic, you know, how do I clear out, or how do I get rid of that other stuff? And really the most efficient and effective way to clear that out, unfortunately, is to erase your phone and restore the data. So you're going to connect it into iTunes via the cable, right? You're going to back it up. Make sure you do a full backup before even trying this. And I would even encourage you to back up any critical photos or files or things like that. And then on the device, once you've backed it up, you can go into your iPhone, go into Settings, General, Reset, and choose the Erase All Content option. And this is really the scary part. I hate doing this. It's going to blow out all of the content on your iPhone. But then what you're going to do is you're going to reconnect your device back into iTunes and then restore your data from backup. So you're going to restore the phone. And I know I really don't like doing this. I kind of just live with that other category, I think, longer than I'd really like. Eventually, at some point, will have to restore my phone for some other reason, and I kind of handle it then, right? I go ahead and do an erase and restore. But if all of this is a little bit too scary for you, there are some other things you can kind of do to try and clear out that content. The other thing I want to mention about that last process before we move on, though, check with your applications too, because I've had some applications where you back up the data, or you think you back up the data, and it doesn't get restored back on. And specifically, the big one for me is things like Paper by 53, where I've done a bunch of drawings and I have a bunch of albums. Or I think I had this issue also with Note Shelf, which is one of my favorite note-taking applications, where the data didn't come back. And I had to go back in and I had to use an app like PhoneView to copy the app's data from my backup back onto the device. Or actually, more appropriately, I had to go into PhoneView, back up the data, like take it off of the phone, out of the app first, save a copy of it, go through the whole reset procedure, and then manually copy that data back on once I'd restored the app. So not a fun process. So if all of this is a little too scary, there's some other things that you can do. You can go into Settings, General, Usage on your device and Manage Storage. And within there, you can then see which apps are using the most data. And specifically the data for other that you want to look for, you need to make sure that you click through that view. So you'll see the app, and it'll show how much storage that app is using up. But within that storage, you have two, basically what amounts to two numbers. You have the amount of space the app itself takes up, so however big the application is. And then a separate thing is the documents and data that that app has stored. And that's the portion that falls into that other category. And so you want to look at that. So you're going to have to click on the app, go into the detail view, and then you'll see the documents and data. And what you'll find is some apps don't use, you know, they might show that they're using up a lot of storage, but very little of that is in the documents and data portion. So you want to, you know, try and figure out which ones are the ones that have the most documents and data. And then the easiest way to clear those out, again, would be to delete the original apps. And keep in mind, when you delete apps, you lose or can lose the data, and it's not going to be restored. So you might have to go back through, like I said, that procedure with something like PhoneView or iExplorer or whatever it is, and get that data back on manually. Another great way to get a lot of the other data back, if you remember, I mentioned earlier, any email messages with attachments, or more specifically, iMessages or SMS conversations that have a lot of media files. If you clean those out or delete those threads, you can get quite a bit of storage back usually. And you can just delete just the media files, or even just save them off and then delete them by going into the message itself, tapping on the details, and then you can tap and hold on one of the media files. So in iOS 8, you have all your media files within a thread consolidated in this little grid view. If you tap and hold on one of those media files and then tap the more option, you can select multiple images and media. You'll get a little blue check mark on each one. And then down at the bottom, there's a tap to save, or a tap, or a little trash can icon that you can use to delete them and save more space and get data back. So there you go. That's that other category, and how you can kind of clear it out, reset it, and maybe get some of that valuable iOS storage space back. Do you think Siri knows a little bit too much about you? I sometimes do. And actually, it was somewhat proven by a post that I saw over on the unofficial Apple weblog about how you can use Siri on a lost iPhone, even if that iPhone is locked, to help find its owner. And so if you pick up your iPhone right on the lock screen and hold down the button to activate Siri, you can say, "Siri, who does this phone belong to?" And then Siri will happily give up all of the information that is in the Mi contact card for the owner of that phone. So in my case, when I did this, it was like every phone number, every email, every relationship that I had entered into my contact. So things like who my spouse was, who my brother was, who my mom is, if I have any children, all of that information is fully freely given up by Siri on the lock screen. And you can even ask her specific things. So you don't have to just say, "Who does phone belong to?" You could say, "Who is my spouse?" or "Who is my brother?" And she will happily answer those questions right from the lock screen. And the unofficial Apple weblog was sort of making this like, oh, this is a great feature because if you find a lost phone, you can find its owner, which may be the case. I mean, that's kind of nice, but maybe you don't want this information available to anybody who finds your phone. And if you don't want this, what you need to do is disable Siri access from the lock screen. So on your iOS device, launch Settings, tap on the Touch ID and Passcode option, and you'll have to enter your passcode when prompted in order to continue, and then scroll down to the Allow Access When Locked section, and you can then turn off Siri. There's also a number of other features like Notification Center and those sorts of things that you can turn off here as well. And if you have Touch ID, it's really not too inconvenient because you can just tap to unlock your phone and then use Siri. It's like one extra little tap, and it adds a lot of extra security. I do this on my devices because literally I just don't want that kind of information available from the lock screen. More though, I sort of wish you didn't have to do this. I wish there was a way to limit what information was displayed in the Mi card on the lock screen. So I might actually throw that into Apple's feedback site just as a suggestion. Say, hey, You know, can we somehow define in our contact card, okay, this is public information, this is private information, and anything that shows up on the lock screen would be only those things that we labeled as public. And if you do want an alternative, you know, because this is a cool feature to have it so if someone found your phone, they can get it back to you. Good alternatives have existed for a while. I think there's apps that'll do this, or you can use Photoshop to just set up a lock screen wallpaper that has a little message just in the image itself. You know, if lost, call, and then list a phone number and reward. And that is a great way to go. I've seen a bunch of people do that. And now also you do have, this is a would be a little bit harder to find if someone was trying to locate you, but someone who understood or knew iOS and how it worked, you could use the new feature of HealthKit, the emergency card. This is the medical ID card that can be brought up from the phone screen under the emergency section in case you were in an accident or something like that and they needed some of your medical information. So the way you set this up is through the Health app in iOS 8. Open up the Health app, tap on Medical ID, and then you can add emergency contact information. So you could put a label in there that just said owner of iPhone or owner or me on the label and then enter in a phone number. And then if someone were to find your phone on the lock screen, they could tap the emergency link and then on medical ID and that info would pop right up. So you kind of control, you know, just having your phone number show up in that medical ID. But I think for right now, you know, the best way to do this is just set up a lock screen wallpaper and have it handled that way. But I wanted to point this out because, yeah, it's a cool feature, but you also need to be aware that Siri does give up quite a bit of information on the lock screen if you allow that feature to be enabled. And I think we've talked about this in the past, but I thought it was worth bringing up again when I saw that article. Now, sticking with Siri here a little bit, I received a comment from Jim, and he has a problem that I think a lot of us have in our lives where, you know, our partners, our friends, sometimes people, including Siri, just won't listen to us.
Hi, Adam. This is Jim from Vancouver, British Columbia. I have a question about using dictation for sending messages. Often when I use iOS, I'm walking around with my headphones plugged in, and I do the usual thing of holding down the button and asking Siri to send a text message. I begin to dictate my message, and if I pause for more than, it seems like, a tenth of a second, Siri moves to the next action in her list, which is to tell me what the message is and ask me if I want to send it. And then I'm left saying, add to it, and adding more stuff to my message. Is there any way that Siri can not be so quick to send and actually listen to what I'm saying and wait for a longer pause? I find this behavior very frustrating and it reduces the usability of the feature. Has anyone else written in with a similar comment?
No, Jim, actually, no one's written. You're the first person to write in about this, but I'm sure we've all experienced it. I know I've experienced it, and it's very frustrating, right? You're trying to give Siri a command and you stumble just a hair. And suddenly she's off doing her thing. You're like, no, wait, it wasn't quite finished yet. And you're right, the command add to it is a really great command and something that not everybody knows about. So in case you didn't know about this feature of Siri, if you're dictating to Siri or giving a command and you do get cut short, you can simply reactivate Siri, say add to it, and it will add to, say, a text message that you might be sending. There's also the command change it if things have just been botched up and are completely wrong and you need to start over and redo everything. You can say change it and Siri will allow you to, you know, redictate whatever message you were trying to dictate. But let me help you out, Jim, because there is a way to get Siri to be a better listener for you. And all you have to do is press and hold the button to activate Siri like you normally would, but don't let go. Once Siri, you know, you get that familiar Siri chime and when you know she's listening and you get the little waveform, just keep the button held down and Siri will continue to listen until you actually release the button. I think there might be a limit, 60, 90 seconds, something like that, but you can talk a lot longer and then just simply release the button and then Siri will go off and do her thing. I wish there was a setting that you could maybe control, or maybe just Apple could make Siri a little bit smarter about recognizing how people speak and occasionally we do have pauses in our speech, and that's totally normal. But, you know, right now that pause is the trigger for Siri to go, oh, I'm done listening. I'm going to go do my thing. So holding the button down should help you out. And thanks for the comment. Appreciate the voicemail. Brad sent me an email this week that really got me stumped a little bit. He had this strange screenshot of his login screen, and it was showing something I had never seen before. It was clearly, or I shouldn't say clearly, because I don't think it was the OS X login screen, but it was something that looked like an OS X login screen. It had an avatar image, though, and the avatar image, rather than being, you know, whatever friendly face you picked, a cat or, you know, the own selfie you shot with the EyeSight camera, it just had a little silhouette with a question mark in it. And then under that, instead of the login name or the short name, there was an orange check mark, and then in square brackets, the words need or update needed. And Brad said that what was going on was his operating system was completely up to date. He was seeing this on the login screen. It would allow him to type in his login password, and then it would sort of flash, blink, whatever, and then go to the standard login screen, and then he could log in as normal. And so it was like, why is it saying update needed? I'm up to date. Everything's fine. And I was thinking the same thing. I was kind of scratching my head, but a good little bit of Googling and checking around, of course, brought the answer. And it basically is that the update needed that you're seeing, Brad, is not the same thing as an OS update. It seems like it might be telling you that, but it really isn't. What it actually is it's a file vault thing. And just between you and me, I already emailed Brad and confirmed, yes, he was using file vault. And as a matter of fact, if you've installed OS X Yosemite recently, you'll note that OS X Yosemite prompts you to actually turn on file vault. So I have a feeling a lot more people are going to be using file vault, and it's likely that many of you might run into this exact issue, because what's happening is when you set up file vault encrypts your entire hard drive, and the drive is encrypted until you actually log in, meaning that none of the data on that drive can be accessed at all. So if you can imagine, you're booting up your operating system, you get to the login screen, there's some information in the login screen that would be stored on the hard drive. So you have to have that information be able to come up before you've actually decrypted the drive. Things like your username or that little login avatar image. But how can it display that if the data is encrypted? Well, what File Vault does is it actually creates a small, unencrypted boot shim partition to store that little bit of data that it needs to kind of do what it needs to do for the login screen. So if things on your Mac change, and I, you know, guess your Mac can sometimes lose access to this little shim, or something happens and the shim needs to get recreated, that's going to take decrypting the drive. And so the little update needed message is basically saying, I need to update this little boot shim, and I can't because everything's encrypted. So the way to fix this is essentially to decrypt the drive, get it rebuilt in File Vault, and then re-encrypt the drive. Now, before you totally go through that process, one thing you might want to do is look in the File Vault preference pane. Some people had reported seeing a little error message in there when they were getting this update needed message that said not all accounts can decrypt this disk. And then that apparently would somehow allow them, I haven't actually experienced this, so I don't really know, but that would apparently somehow allow them to, from there, supply all of the passwords for the different accounts on the Mac, and that would get rid of the message. But that didn't seem to be the fix for everyone. Really, the full fix seemed to be to turn off File Vault and then to re-enable File Vault, and that would sort of clean things up. And so the way you do this is you go into System Preferences, you go into Security and Privacy, into File Vault, and then you're going to have to click the little lock at the bottom, enter your admin credentials to be able to make changes to File Vault, and then just simply disable File Vault. Now, the thing is when you disable File Vault, it has to, because File Vault encrypts the entire drive, it has to decrypt the entire drive. And just be prepared, this can take a long time, approximately 1.5 hours for every 500 gigs of storage. So if you have a 1 terabyte drive, it might take 2-3 hours for this decryption to happen, maybe even longer. The good news is that decryption process can actually happen in the background. So you can disable it, continue to use your Mac as normal while it's going on. And even if you have to reboot or restart, or you want to shut down and start it up in the morning, it will just pick up where it left off. So you don't have to wait around for it. It's going to happen. But then once it's been decrypted, then you can go back in. You can re-enable File Vault. And again, it's going to have to go through and encrypt the entire hard drive. And again, that will take a long time. But once again, you can have it going in the background. So you really don't have to worry about it. It's just a matter of toggling the switch, waiting, toggling it back on, waiting. And that should resolve that needs update problem on the login screen. So Brad, I know he already emailed me back because I had sent him the solution and it did work for him. It just took a long time to do the encryption decryption thing. So if you're using File Vault and you see this update needed on the login screen, that's how you fix it. And then the last thing that I have for you in today's show is my thing of the moment. This is a new segment we're doing. You know, a lot of shows have their sort of picks. I don't always have kind of a new fancy thing that I'm excited about, but when I do, I'm going to try and share some of that stuff with you on the MacCast. And so far, it's been fun. I've been having fun talking to you about some of my favorite apps and products and things like that. And this week is no exception because a couple weeks ago, maybe even a month ago, I bought a USB hub. And yeah, you wouldn't think a USB hub is that exciting, but you know, I have a MacBook Pro, a 15-inch MacBook Pro 2011, and it was kind of a mess because I have, you know, I'm fanatical about backups, so I've got a ton of external USB hard drives. I've got a USB audio interface for doing the podcast. I've got a Thunderbolt display, you know, or a mini display port, really display, but I've got an external display hooked up on Thunderbolt. And so I've got all these wires kind of coming out the side of my MacBook. And I had a little hub that I think was a little 4-port hub. And it was just kind of a mess. And I really didn't like it. And it made docking and undocking my MacBook Pro when I was, you know, moving in and out of the office, not very convenient. And I thought about getting like a Thunderbolt docking solution, but I really hadn't found one that blew my socks off. Now, I'll tell you this, OWC has a new Thunderbolt 2 dock that I think may end up being a thing of the moment pick in the future because it is amazing. It's got, you know, everything one could possibly need. I think it's like 5 USB ports, 2 Thunderbolt ports, an HDMI port, Ethernet, you know, everything in there. And a FireWire port as well. So I may replace this hub with that. But until then, this Satachi 10-port USB premium aluminum hub, you can get it at satachi.net. That's SATECHI.net. I actually got mine on Amazon for $59 US. And I have Prime, so it was really, really awesome. You might be able to find it cheaper. I don't know. But this is basically a 7-port. They label it as a 10-port USB hub, but it's actually 7 USB ports and 3 USB charging ports. So you get 7 ports and 3 charging ports. And it is USB 3.0, so you have supporting transfer rates up to 5 gigabits per second. The 3 charging ports, and what's really nice is they're all labeled. They all have 5 volts, but one is a 2.1 amp port, so for charging things like your iPads, and then you have your standard 1 amp ports, 2 of those. And what I really like about this is that all of the ports are on the front, and the front of the hub, it looks a lot like a Apple keyboard. It's kind of got the round part at the back, and then it slants at a 45-degree angle, and it's all aluminum and white, and the ports themselves are labeled. Specifically, the charging ports have nice labels on them that you can see. It makes connecting your devices really easy. I was able to place it at the back of my desk behind my MacBook Pro, so that kept all the wires clean. They're all kind of hidden back there, and I can get easy access to them, so I just kind of pull down the laptop screen, and I can plug into those charging ports when I need to charge up my devices. And like I said, it's aluminum and white, so it matches your Apple gear perfectly. And for me, the price was totally right. $60. cleaned up everything. And now when I need to set up my MacBook Pro, I really only have two cables. I have the Thunderbolt cable and the one USB cable going to the Satachi device. And it's fabulous. I absolutely love it. So check that out. I'll have links to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their software by going to smilesoftware.com. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free 10-day trial of lynda.com by going to lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send me an email or an audio attachment. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave voicemail. The phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or you can leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype handle is the MacCast. Be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we have a Google Plus community. If you're on Google Plus, just search for MacCast and you will find us there. But with that, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.